You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Developments in the Steinhoff scandal, particularly the forfeiture of assets belonging to Marcus Joosten's former partner Bernardine Odendaal, have set something of a legal precedent in the fight against corporate fraud in South Africa. With the clutter of financial irregularities that came to light after the scandal, the Reserve Bank and other regulatory bodies have been pivotal in untangling and addressing all of this malfeasance. That's a view now from my next guest, who is Danny Naidu, a director at Fairbridge's Wertheim Becker Attorneys. Welcome to you and thank you very much for talking to us. First of all, could you explain to me the legal basis for the forfeiture of assets in this particular instance, particularly in the absence of a criminal conviction?
Yes, so this is a question that has been lurking, especially since the initial assets were frozen and now obviously the forfeiture, especially when you consider Marcus Joosten's death. The exchange control regulations are quite clear, and it's quite clearly set out in 22A, B and C of when the South African Reserve Bank can take control of assets and when they can forfeit. And the basis for the forfeiture is that there's a reasonable belief that there was a contravention of these assets. Not only that, that the flow of the funds were as a result of illicit activity. And that's what has happened here. It's money that flowed into South Africa, into various different entities, and almost guised to be something of clean money, but it actually wasn't. And the exchange control regulations are saying, hold on, this is not legal, this is untoward. There are clear contraventions in respect of our regulations, and based on that, we are forfeiting these amounts, whether held directly or indirectly. It's in regards to who has the position of those funds.
How difficult is it to prove reasonable belief in a case like this? What do you have to present in order for that to happen?
It would have to be looking at the clear direct flow of the money, as well as the conduct of the parties under the period that the money was then flowed. And based on that, for them to look at the various contraventions that the parties were in fact guilty of, and then as a result, go ahead to court and get this preservation. So they froze the assets, they were pending investigations, and from then to now, there's now this reasonable belief that these assets were not valid assets. And based on that, it has been forfeited, which is very different to other legislation that you have, like the prevention of organized crime, where the state will also say, okay, look, here are these parties. These are the parties that we believe have committed a criminal offense. And based on that, we are freezing assets pending a criminal trial and conviction. But there has to be a conviction before the state can confiscate those funds. The exchange control regulations, quite draconian, but very much alive and well in South Africa, and they implement this process.
If I've understood this correctly, there was another conundrum as well as far as the Odendaal case was concerned, and that was addressing the issue of asset ownership versus something called beneficiary status in asset forfeiture. How do you make a differentiation between the two?
So beneficial ownership is where a lot of these assets were in her name, and she was having a direct benefit. Indicative of that is obviously the properties, as well as the application that that went all the way to the SCA that she had launched, where she needed reasonable expenses to be paid for and basically her upkeep to be maintained. But when you look at the flow of the money, and the exchange control regulations are quite clear under sections 22A, C and B, is that the money doesn't necessarily have to be in the possession of the accused or the perpetrator. It's just whoever's possession it is that flowed from some sort of contravention. So yes, she had beneficial ownership, but now that these assets have been forfeited, that beneficial ownership argument goes away. And now the question is, does she have legal standing to go and contest this under a review process? Because the exchange control regulations are saying, well, actually, she never really was entitled to that money and she never really owned that money. So that is something that's there, which will be quite interesting to see how it's dealt with and the remedies that will be taken. It would probably have to be the entities that held these assets, which would then have to go and possibly look at review proceedings. But for her to do it, it would be quite difficult, especially when you look at her being unsuccessful in her application to the SCA for her expenses to be paid for.
How difficult would it be then for her to contest this and seek the kind of recourse that she would want?
I would say it's going to be quite difficult, and it's going to be quite a lengthy, costly exercise. I don't know what her other means are financially and the type of legal advice that she would get. The other difficulty that she faces is that money wasn't really held by her. It was held by her indirectly and flowed from other entities. So for the likes of his trusts, those would probably be the correct entities that would have the proper legal standing to try and review this forfeiture that has now taken place. I don't know if she will be quite successful in a review under these circumstances.
So what happens then to those forfeited assets once they are transferred to the National Revenue Fund? What's the process there and how long would they stay there for?
So that would be to the benefit of the fund, and that would then be utilized towards expenses for states, you know, government officials, upkeep, almost looking at like what your tax money is really doing. It's basically money that the state is now entitled to hold that they can use in respect of payments for regulated bodies.
Is there broader impact then in terms of legal precedent on corporate fraud prevention strategy in South Africa? In other words, what changes as a result of this?
So look, Jeremy, you would know, and it's been all over the news when you look at state capture, when you look at where corporate South Africa is, when you look at what's really in the public domain with individuals, entities, banks, etc. This is already a discussion point that a lot more people are speaking about and a lot more people are engaging in. I think where the difference would be is, I mean, these regulations have been around forever. So has other legislation. So they've always been there. It's just that now it's more in the public domain of how they're being utilized and what the actual impact is. I think something like this is definitely going to make South African individuals that have entities and are dealing with cross-border transactions, for them to be a much more alive to how they are actually dealing with their funds and to be alive of the possibility of contraventions and to seek proper legal advice in terms of their day-to-day conduct. Because the result of them not doing that and the result of them being in some form of contravention is going to have an adverse effect, as you can see here. And I think based on this and based on the severity of the impact on her specifically in terms of her livelihood and the value of the assets that have now been forfeited, I think a lot more people are going to be a bit more cautious about, you know, not ticking all the right boxes and trying to disguise the flow of money.
And I'm going to thank you very much indeed for that explanation, Dahini Naidoo. I appreciate it.